From 9 to 5 Mac, this is your friendly spelunking podcast, Stack Trace, with your hosts, me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Guy?
Hey, I think we should change the tagline for the podcast to be your friendly spelunking podcast.
Your friendly neighborhood spelunking podcast.
Yeah, that sounds friendly and spelunky.
I think so. So that is a good name for the show because we always talk about spelunking, but especially so this week because you've been doing a ton of spelunking and a little bit of a different kind of spelunking, right? So what have you been up to lately?
Yeah, unfortunately, as many of our listeners may or may not know, iOS devices like iPhones and iPads, they're very limited as to what type of hacking you can do with them. So I am able to do quite a bit with a regular vanilla device that doesn't have any particular modifications done to it. But it's way more fun when you can do literally anything, like anything you can think of. And that's only achievable if you have a jailbroken iOS device.
That's sweet, sweet root access.
Oh, yeah. And I've been very, very lucky. I think, I don't know if I told you this, but I'm kind of ashamed because I have a problem, as you know. But I bought another iPhone.
Yeah, you did tell me about that because you were able to get one that had a version of iOS that you could actually jailbreak.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I didn't know it did. I only knew it when it arrived. So.
Oh, really? It was like a chance?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Yeah, talk about playing poker.
Since I didn't win the WWDC lottery, I thought, well, I haven't spent my luck this year yet, so let's throw the dice. So, yeah, so I logged into an eBay-like website we have here, and there were a couple of sellers selling the iPhone X, which is not sold officially anymore by Apple.
Right.
And I found one that looked like the listing was from a while ago. Like, it was from the beginning of the iOS 12 era. And it didn't mention any OS version, and I didn't want to ask. Because if I did ask, they would probably just say, oh, it's on the latest version. Because that's like the standard response. So what I did was I purchased it, and when it arrived, I had the first sign that I got lucky. And can you imagine what sign this was?
Let's see. Has it something to do with like the packaging or something? Like, can you identify what batch of production it is from the packaging or something?
No, the first sign I got that I had gotten lucky was that the battery was completely dead.
Ah, right, which means that it's old, yeah.
Yeah, it means it was in the box for a long time.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's what I was saying on the last episode with Steven, is that how much I love that when you receive an Apple product, the battery is almost always, like, not full, but you can always use it. But yeah, that was not the case here, which means that that phone must have been sitting in some warehouse for a long time.
Yeah, so I was hoping for something like between iOS 11.1 and iOS 12.1 because that's like the sweet spot for jailbreaking. But I got even luckier.
Oh, wow.
It was in iOS 12.1.2, which happens to be the latest version of iOS that can be jailbroken.
Oh, that's perfect. So you've got all the latest updates, like the latest updates that you can get and still jailbreak.
Yeah, it's like the top of the line on the jailbreaking device scene. So it's an
right.
iPhone 10 with iOS 12.1.2 because you can't jailbreak 8.12 devices as of yet.
Oh, I see. All right. Imagine Apple having that lineup, like here's our normal lineup and here's our jailbroken lineup.
Yeah, so I got lucky, and now I'm treating this as like this special jewel that I can't damage in any way because I don't think I would be lucky again to get a device in the same state as this one.
Yeah. So what have you been doing with your newfound jailbroken powers, or rather your newfound jailbroken playground?
Something I've always wanted to do was to capture images using the infrared camera on the iPhone X. And as far as I know, that's not possible without a jailbreak. And I was able to do just that. As you've probably seen, you, John, you saw my initial testing, but people have already seen this on my Twitter feed.
Yeah, I called it the Blair Rambo Project. Because it really looks like, when you sent me that first video, which you just sent kind of out of the blue in our iMessage conversation, I thought it was like you watching a horror movie or something, because it really looked like that, you know, very obviously black and white, because there are no colors in infrared, or, you know, you just get that spectrum in from black and white. That's how you render it. And like a lot of grain, and you know, the colors were really like distorted and stuff like that. So, yeah, I was like, what kind of horror movie is this? Oh, wait, Rambo is doing something weird with selfies. Oh, OK, IR camera. That's cool.
Yeah, it was super creepy, the first one, especially because I had the IR projector off. So it was just like the IR light that's present naturally in the environment, and probably some from the device's on screen. So I had to get my face really close to the camera to actually capture anything.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it was just black. And yeah, it looked really creepy.
Yeah, totally. So what has been the point of this, besides kind of doing something fun and, you know, getting these creepy videos out of it? Like, are you attempting to learn more about how the like AR sensor is working under the hood, and, you know, how Face ID works in terms of the IR sensor?
Yeah, it's fun. First of all, that's what I'm doing it. But it's also an experience to learn how the, not only how Face ID works under the hood, but also how the hardware itself is controlled by the software, because this is diving into some pretty low-level stuff, which we usually don't go to on iOS. It's more common on desktops, but on iOS we usually don't, we don't set like current and voltage levels on components.
Right. You don't render your UI view by setting it to like 12 volts.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the most interesting aspect to me, and also to like have this this vision of how Face ID sees you, which is what I use for my post. Like, this is how Face ID sees you.
Yeah.
And it uses three different types of IR lights. It uses the flawed illuminator, which basically is used to detect that there's a face at all in the image. And then it uses two different IR dot patterns. One is the sparse one, which is the dots are more spread out. And the other one is a dense one where there are lots of little dots.
Cool. And there are also two IR sensors, right? Because it needs to be able to capture depth. Or how does that work?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I think they use a combination of the IR sensor itself plus the regular camera sensor. So they use both at the same time.
Okay. I wonder how that works, because the whole point of Face ID is that it also works in the dark, right? Because it doesn't need that like actual light. It doesn't need that ambient light in order to work. Maybe the camera just comes into play in order to like really detect kind of high level shapes and stuff like that doesn't need a lot of light. Because I'm wondering, like, if they would need to use the regular camera, how that would work if the room is pitch black.
Yeah, but it projects this dot pattern on your face. And given that the pattern is known by the system, they can detect the distortion on this pattern. And that gives it the 3D it needs.
So the regular camera can also see IR light?
No, the IR camera sees the dots.
Right, exactly. Oh, and yeah. Then it can convey that information to the regular camera. That's what you mean, or?
The dots are distorted by the curves on your face. Like, if you project the dots onto a flat white wall, mm-hmm. it's just like a bunch of dots. But if you project them on your face has curves and that distorts the dots in different directions.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, that's super interesting stuff.
IR lasers, John.
It's yeah, so IR lasers. It's the future. It's yeah. funny because, you know, if you think about it, like what you've been spending the last week or so doing is like shooting IR lasers into your face.
Yeah, I was kind of scared a little bit. And during my first tests, I wasn't pointing it at my face at all because who knows, maybe I activated the IR blast your vision mode and it was
the Death
going
Star
to make
mode.
You blind.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that would be terrible. It's good that you're taking the scientific precautions, Rambo. I hope that you're also wearing the lab glasses and the lab coat and everything, you know, while you're performing this in a 100% sterile environment.
Yeah, it was interesting because I turned all the lights off because I didn't want all the lights on my apartment to interfere with the IR. So I was working in pitch black, basically, with just the light from my computer screen. So
that must have been cozy. Yeah, nice.
Yeah, I looked like a typical hacker. was just missing the hoodie.
Yeah, exactly. That was appropriate given the task that you were performing.
Yeah, exactly. So, John, what have you been doing? I noticed.
So, I've been getting back into open source again, which I'm really excited about. Yeah, and I'm not done yet. I'm hopefully releasing one more project this week. So to recap, I've been open sourcing two projects recently. And the first one is called Sweep, which is a string scanning algorithm, which is a fancy way of saying searching for a piece of text or a substring between different characters. So some of the use cases that I have for this are for parsing text. So as I've talked about on this show before, I am building a static site generator for the new version of Swift by Sundell. And what I've decided to do with the static site generator is to try to split it out into separate modules as much as possible to build like a really modular system. Because one thing I've come to realize lately is I really love to work on small components, like small types or small functions or even small packages, because that way you have a very kind of constrained system that you're working with. So you can more easily decide what goes into this package and what should go into some other package. So Sweep is a good example of that, where it's going to be used for my static site generator, but only for the parts where I am searching all the different markdown files for titles, for metadata, like dates, for tags. And, you know, in the future, I could also do things like search for links and then maybe build like a list of related articles from those links that I find inline. And this is all what Sweep can do. So Sweep is basically you give it a string and you'd say, oh, I want to find substrings that appear between these two characters. So that could be, for example, quotation marks or, you know, HTML comments or whatever you want to scan for. And it does it in a really efficient way.
It sounds very easy, but I know for a fact that this type of algorithm can go wrong in many ways.
Yeah, definitely. I've got a lot of help from Swift itself. I know that a lot of Swift developers, initially when you start working with strings in Swift, you might be under the impression that the API is very cumbersome, that it's not very convenient, because in so many other languages, you can just say to a string, give me the fifth character, and you can just do a subscript to get the fifth character. In Swift, you can't do that. And at first, it might seem like, you know, really convenient and really hard to work with. But this is a case like when you're doing something like string scanning or parsing, or, you know, with Splash, for example, my syntax highlighter, when I'm doing like tokenization on a string and actually like figuring out what's a function and what's a variable, etc. All these use cases, like the way strings are implemented in Swift makes those things so much less error prone and so much easier to write. Because even though Swift strings can sometimes feel a little bit hard to work with, kind of, you know, when you just want to get something done, they are extremely well designed. It's one of the most well designed APIs in this whole standard library, in my opinion. It's it's super type safe, and it's very hard to do something wrong because it really forces you to do the right thing in terms of, you know, always using the right string indexes, in terms of, you know, how you iterate through a string and how you treat a character. And it doesn't allow you to make any like dangerous assumptions that, like you say, Rambo, where these kind of tasks can quickly go wrong.
Yeah, I think one day we should talk about how computers represent text.
Yeah.
I think that would be a really cool subject if we can come up with a way to talk about it without boring our audience to death.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Just yeah. As a very concrete example, I know we're getting really into the weeds here, but one concrete example of just what makes strings complicated is, for example, emoji. Because when you look at emoji, like the actual rendered emoji, if you take the family emoji as an example, it's just one character to what you see. It just looks like one character. But actually, under the hood, it's many characters, because so many emojis, they are represented using combinations. Like, to get the family emoji with, you know, one man, one woman, and two kids, you actually take, like, the man emoji, the woman emoji, and the two kid emojis, and you combine them. That's how you get that emoji cluster, if you will. So... Mm-hmm. That makes iterating over strings using just like making the assumption that what you see on the screen is also in code completely dangerous, because for emoji, those things aren't correct.
Yeah, and there are also even some social issues that come up with, I noticed, I don't remember where I saw this, but there's this prohibited sign emoji, and you can combine it with other emoji to basically make anything prohibited.
And oh, right.
Depending on what you combine it with, let's say some specific flag or some specific type of people, you can make some quite offensive emoji because yeah. they didn't think about it when designing this.
Right, yeah, exactly. The whole system, like with UTF-8 and you know, how you can use these combination characters to combine things, they're super powerful, but it can lead to some tricky situations. But it's really fundamental to how like UTF-8 encoding works, and the reason it's so becomes so widespread and really become a standard, because you can really use it to form so many different characters just by combining different ones. And that's what makes Swift's string API so good, because it handles all those cases for you by kind of quote-unquote forcing you to do the right thing, to use proper string indexes instead of using just integers, and you know, the way it lets you iterate over a string and things like that. So it has made me implement both Splash and now Sweep in a much, much safer way, and also in a more efficient way. So Sweep is actually just like 150 lines of code or something. So it's not that much, but because Swift String really does a lot of the heavy lifting for me.
Yeah, that's really nice. And how about the other one?
So the other one is extensions on top of Swift's Codable API. So it's called Code Extended. It's meant basically as a convenience API for when you're decoding data in your code. So Swift has this built-in API called Codable, which enables you to very easily create data structures that can be represented with, for example, JSON or some other serialized formats, modern data formats. And the defaults in Codable are super powerful, because you can just declare a type. Let's say you have a user that has a name and an age. You can just declare that in Swift, and Codable will just automatically synthesize all of the decoding and encoding code that you need to move that user from and to a serialized format. However, if you need to customize things, they start getting verbose very quickly. And yeah. I just talk about string and how I feel like that's so well-designed, and I don't mind if it's more verbose because I know it's for a good reason. With Codable, I don't really think that. I think that there might be good reasons for the way the API is designed, but it frustrates me when I need to use it that way. So I wrote a bunch of extensions to make life a little bit easier for when you do need to make those customizations, to make them basically into one line of code instead of, you know, five lines of code.
I actually wrote my own encoder and decoder for Codable once.
Ooh, nice.
And man, it's tricky. Oh my God, yeah. It's super tricky. Yeah, and basically what you have to do is copy the implementation for one of the official ones that come with Swift, because they're open source.
Yeah.
So I think I just copied the one from JSON, and then I added like fatal error to everything, that I didn't know how to implement. And at runtime, I would check when it's called because it would crash, basically.
That's the best kind of development, right? Fatal error-driven development.
Exactly. And then I would implement it, and that's how CloudKit Codable came to be.
Ooh, nice. Yeah, I mean, I do have a lot of empathy or sympathy for, you know, the people who had to write Codable or implement it, because it is not an easy problem to solve. And I've written decoders and encoders, and it's not easy because, number one, there are so many edge cases. And number two, you want to be able to represent any kind of data using the same API. So that's what Codable does. Like, you can encode to and from JSON, XML, plist, and now you've added support for CloudKit. You could add support for other formats, but you can do it with the same API. And supporting all those different formats using the same API is extremely tricky.
Yeah, and the main Codable encoding and decoding is focused on the output. It doesn't have to be, but it's mostly focused on the output being a data object. So just this blob of data. And for CloudKit, it's not. It's a CK record, which is basically a dictionary. So I had to do some tricks there to make it work with basically a dictionary instead of data as input and output.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah. And I'm actually going to confess that I am not using it in production yet, just because I'm not sure how safe the implementation actually is. But we'll see.
We'll see one day, yeah. Yeah, so that's been my two open source projects, and hopefully there will be one more this week, and also, like, I will continue, because I am planning to open source this whole suite of tools for my static site generation, and I am just open sourcing them, like, as I build them. So I have this plan of how I'm going to build the whole generator itself. And as I'm finishing one part of it as a self-contained package, I'm just open sourcing that, which I'm really enjoying this workflow. And I also think that it will make the whole generator both more flexible, because you'll be able to just use parts of it if you want. And also, it's just it's a good resource for the community, just to see how things like string scanning are implemented in an efficient way, or, you know, what you can do with Codable and things like that. So yeah, I'm really enjoying this work, and I hope that, you know, it's useful for people.
Yeah, that's really nice. And you actually got me inspired, and I'm thinking about some neat little things I have that I could make open source. Looking forward to that. And my stuff is usually less Swifty and more UI related or debugging related, or even spelunking related.
That's why we make a good team, you and I, right? I'm all about Swift, and you're all about the UI and spelunking. So that's very good.
Yep.
All right. So let's move on now and talk about our next topic, or actually our first proper topic. This was a long "What are we up to?" segment, but, you know, it was a lot of fun.
That's because we are up to a lot.
Yeah, that's true. So last episode, we had a special episode with Stephen Hackett, which was a lot of fun. We went through the whole history of Apple and the Mac and everything. But because we did that special episode, we didn't have time to properly talk about AirPower. And for those of you who heard the little Easter egg at the end, we heard a lot of people appreciated that. That was it was great feedback to get that. Our little eulogy for AirPower. But we wanted to dive a little bit deeper into it. Not so much about, like, speculating about what went wrong inside Apple or the process, but to more talk about what we think about this cancellation. And also, Rambo, you've been doing a little bit of a special project to, quote-unquote, bring AirPower back to life. So we want to talk about that too. But first things first. So what are your thoughts on AirPower being canceled, except for you being very, very sad about this?
I was going to say the thought is that I'm very sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mentioned this, I think, on Twitter or to some people somewhere, but the main issue with this cancellation is that Apple announced the product.
Yeah.
If they hadn't announced it, we would never have heard about it. Maybe I would have found something on some system that maybe pointed towards Apple doing something with wireless charging. But yeah, this was a big mistake, because they announced it at a very special event, the first event they did at the Steve Jobs Theater, when they released what would become the next generation of iPhone devices for the next decade, like they said at the event, the iPhone X. And then they included the product in their website and in press releases, in product boxes, in product manuals. So yeah, it was a big oops by Apple. They shouldn't have announced it. And that was the main mistake. And what makes me even more sad about this, because yeah, it's tricky. And I hope they learn something from this.
Yeah, but it was pretty clear from what we've seen, both in terms of the packaging that has AirPower printed on it, and in terms of what you've been finding as well, because as we've reported on this show, AirPower has kind of led a very, very interesting life in terms of where it's appeared in the software, because in some releases it was there, then it was taken out, then it came back again, and it made us all think that AirPower was going to get released after all. So it also seems that, you know, it doesn't seem like Apple basically figured out that they couldn't make this a year ago and just been keeping their mouth shut. It seems like, you know, things have been going back and forth a lot, and maybe also internally, they hadn't completely figured out what to do with this project.
Yeah, you mentioned you didn't want to speculate, but I do.
Okay, let's speculate.
Yeah, and I also heard from some things that I don't know how true they are, but all things point towards this cancellation having been a last-minute kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like, they had the product ready for mass production, and they were in the late stages of maybe certifying it with regulatory entities, or like doing some last testing to make sure it was sane. And something came up, and what I think came up was probably related to all of these, or at least part of these issues with durability of the product, like how long it would last with constant usage, the safety, so in terms of heating and how it could maybe could damage a product's battery that's charging on it. And also the cost of production for the device.
Yeah.
So I think those three aspects played a role in this cancellation, and that it was a last minute kind of thing. Because there were so many reports about the product going into mass manufacturing in early 2019.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't think all of those reports are wrong. I think it's hard to believe. So I think there was some last minute thing, and it was probably at the end of the day the safety and durability issues that played the main role in this cancellation.
Yeah, and then the question is, like, if they for some reason got some remarks when they were trying to certify it with governments around the world, that, you know, this didn't pass certain tests. The question is, why didn't they just, you know, take it back and fix it and then bring it back to those government agencies again? But it feels almost like there was this straw that broke the camel's back kind of problem.
Yeah.
Where, it, you know, obviously this whole product development cycle has been plagued by some kind of problems, because, you know, again, we've just been seeing it come back and forth and back and forth. And it was announced to be released in 2018. It didn't come out in 2018, etc. So all evidence points to that it was a troubled development. So maybe it was just like they said, like, if this goes through, if this actually happens, if we are able to do this, then we'll go for it. But if something goes wrong, it's canceled. We're done, right?
Yeah, and there have been some talks about Apple acquired this company that was related to industrial wireless charging applications, something like that. And they were working on AirPower, and then some people from the team were borrowed to work on the Apple Pencil thing with the new iPad Pro, and that also delayed the project. But there have also been some talks from people who really know this stuff, and even people who know physics, saying that basically this product defied the laws of physics.
Right.
That it was basically, it's basically impossible to make something like that.
Yeah, because what they were trying to make wasn't just like, you know, a charging mat where you have three coils and you can just charge three devices. They were making like 30 coils or something, like interlaced on top of each other, like overlapping in order to have full coverage, and you can place the phone anywhere and have it charge. And that generates a lot of problems in terms of just heat, and I'm guessing also things like magnetism and like maybe even like some kind of radiation or electricity can leak. You know, there are so many complicated things when you have something like, you know, induction-based charging or wireless charging on such a small area with so many coils and potentially three different devices charging at the same time.
Yeah, it could even be something as simple as, let's say, it buzzed while it charged.
Yeah, that's unacceptable. Throw it out.
Yeah, there were so many coils resonating that it caused an audible buzzing sound.
Right.
And even if it doesn't mean anything really, it's just a buzzing sound. But this is a product that people would potentially put on their bedside table.
Yeah.
So you can't have something buzzing there. And we know Apple, they are quite... they are perfectionists to some extent. I don't think they would release something that makes a buzzing sound when it's charging. At least not intentionally, of course. The accidents can happen. But I remember when they launched HomePod, how in one of their technical talks about it, they talked about how they worked very hard to make sure HomePod would not make any sound when it's not playing something. Because yeah. There's a powerful amplifier in there with powerful speakers, and that stuff can make noise even when it's not being used. And they work very hard to prevent that. And magnetic radiation and waves, the way waves work in the world, it's kind of tricky. And when there are multiple ones overlapping, weird things can happen. And a very small input can be amplified by these different waves overlapping with each other and can cause chaos.
Yeah.
There's this episode of Mythbusters where they tested this myth of there were soldiers marching on top of a bridge, and they were marching on the resonant frequency of the bridge, and the bridge ended up collapsing because the waves were basically being multiplied and something like that. I don't remember if they confirmed the myth or not, but yeah.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
Look up this episode.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost also like the Oprah singer making all the glass shatter, right? Like, you know, there is some crazy things you can do with just audio waves and light waves. And in this case, also like electromagnetism, I'm guessing also that it gets emitted. So yeah, crazy stuff.
And let's not forget that at the same time, you have potentially three devices with potentially big and powerful lithium-ion batteries on top of this thing that can heat up. And also, they have to communicate with each other and with the mat via another type of electromagnetic wave. And maybe the charging was interfering with that as well, so they couldn't communicate with each other to manage the charging. Maybe the processor inside the product was getting fried by the heat.
Yeah.
And maybe if someone with a pacemaker walked next to it, their pacemaker stopped or something.
Right, because there are all these edge cases to consider. Like, you know, just solving the basic problem is something that they probably figured out. Like, otherwise, they probably wouldn't even have greenlit this product. I'm sure that it wasn't just that someone had an idea to do it and then Phil Schiller said, great, let me get on stage and tell everybody about it, you know?
Yeah, and they had the entire UI thing done by
then.
Yeah,
exactly.
Because it was included in iOS 11, yeah.
There you go, yeah. And everything pointed to it like being in pretty much imminent release, and we know that, you know, Apple has a long lead time on hardware products in general, you know, manufacturing, all that stuff, because, you know, those things take time. So I definitely think that at some point they did, you know, solve the basic problem. But then, as you mentioned, there are all these edge cases, especially when it comes to things like this that has to do with, you know, wireless charging and electricity and heat and things like that. Like, what happens if you place just the most powerful iPhones, like the XS Max, three of them on the same mat, or even more? Like, how does it detect that, and how does it dissipate that heat, etc.? Like,
and also foreign bodies. What if you drop your car keys on top of it?
Yeah, exactly. You don't want to, you know, ruin the car keys because they get, you know, demagnetized or something.
Yeah.
Also, so many things.
There's also the problem of efficiency. Apple is very vocal about how power efficient their products are. Let's say they couldn't make it more efficient than, say, 50%, and 50% of the power went to waste because of all the management that had to be done. Yeah, so there are many, many problems with this product. And yeah, it's sad that it's canceled, but it's also understandable.
Yeah, it is. So that brings us to the second part of this topic, which is that you've been trying to bring AirPower a little bit back to life, or at least parts of it, the parts that you were really looking forward to, the animations.
Yeah, so I did a little prototype last week running a fake home screen on my iPhone XR that I use for testing. And yeah, I noticed that it's doable. You can do it without even using any assets from Apple. You can just get the 3D models and do the rendering yourself. And someone from the jailbreaking community reached out, and they were working on the other part, which was doing the integration with Springboard and showing the list of devices that are charging. So yeah, they were working on the home screen, the lock screen list, and I was working on the animation. So might as well team up and
do this
together. Yeah.
Yeah, and just to clarify, like what we're talking about here is that you place your iPhone on top of a regular Qi charger, like a normal wireless charger from any brand, and then you can see that nice UI that you would see when you would, you know, hypothetically place it on top of AirPower, that nice like a spinning iPhone, you know, coming into view. And then the same thing you also implemented for the Apple Watch as well. So you put the Apple Watch on its charger and you get the same animation there as well.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what we are working on for jailbroken devices. It's probably going to work from iOS 11 and up. And yeah, there's a big amount of people out there with their jailbroken devices who love these little tweaks. So it's a fun project. And yeah. I love this. I mentioned this to you. I love, at a technical level, I love this integration of video and 3D animations with UI. I think that it's a really cool technique, and you can achieve some pretty cool results with it. I'm doing some stuff with this for Chibi Studio as well, for the onboarding.
Yeah, super cool. It's a great way to bring a little bit more of fun and also creativity into these kind of quote-unquote flat UIs that we have these days. So even if you have a UI, which in this case is like a rectangle with the name of the device and an icon, which is, you know, pretty standard flat style UI that we have these days. But if you then bring a 3D animation in there, you can do that without it looking out of place. It just looks, you know, follows the same design language, but it just makes it look so cool.
Yeah, exactly. And I really like it. And they are doing something similar for the Apple Card now. So when you get the Apple Card, you're going to place your iPhone next to the packaging it comes with, which has an NFC tag. And you'll see this UI pop up, which shows a 3D animation of Apple Card, which will even show your name on the animation.
Yeah,
and this
that's
integrates.
Really cool.
Integrates 3D models with video and normal UI kits. So that's fun.
I wonder if it's rendered using SceneKit, right? It's not a video. It's actually a full 3D model that is rendered in real time using SceneKit, right?
It's a mix of both. So it's a video, and the video is used as the background of the scene. And on top of the video, there's a plane that follows the card in the video. So I guess they do the animation in a 3D software, and then they render the video and they export the scene file, and they are combined at runtime. So the plane is composed on top of the video. So they're basically doing a match move with the plane on top of this video. I guess they use the video because they want to have the best render possible, and the best render possible is the one you can do in a 3D software with ray tracing and stuff like that. And they only use SceneKit for the dynamic part of the video.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's really interesting. It can also be for efficiency reasons, you know, just you wouldn't want to render all that those lights and everything, just render like the text and maybe some basic dynamic effects in SceneKit, and the rest is just, you know, baked into that 3D model. It's the same kind of technique that is used in games where you have baked shadows and you have dynamic shadows, where a lot of the shadows you will see in a 3D game are baked, where they are actually rendered offline, like before the game is even running. The game already has all those shadows baked in because they're not moving, which saves a lot of performance because you wouldn't want to calculate all those shadows dynamically in real time, only the ones that are affected by camera angles or character movement and things like that.
Yeah, and if people who are listening want to learn more about this technique, it happens to be the same technique they used for the air power animations. So you can go to my rambo.codes blog and you'll find an article there explaining fairly clearly how this works. And it's very interesting. In the case of air power, they have the 3D scene, which is, it has to have a transparent background. So they have a video file, which is split in two. One side is the color channel. The other one is the alpha channel.
Ooh,
because
nice.
Basically, you can't have transparent video. That's not a thing, at least not on iOS. The QuickTime animation codec supports it, but iOS doesn't. So, and then at runtime, they split the video in two. They use the color part for the color texture and the other part as a Luma mask for the alpha channel. And then there's this scene that has a plane which follows the movement of the device in the video, which is the screen of the device that they compose on top of it. It's really fascinating stuff.
That's super cool. Yeah, again, like techniques that are very common also in game development, for example, to use a specific color or to even use the alpha channel in a texture. Like, let's say you have a texture which you want to color parts of it. You could use the alpha channel for that if you're not using it for transparency. So there are all these tricks you can do with image formats and video formats in order to just, you know, bake more information into them to save space, or, you know, to render faster, or just to make it like a more integrated solution where you can just load one texture and it has all the information you need. So it's cool to see, you know, Apple also employing some of those same techniques, but in a very different domain.
Yeah, definitely. It's very cool. And as you mentioned, I now know a little bit more about game development.
That's perfect. Yeah. There's more overlap between game development and, you know, app/3D development than most people think. Like, most people think of game development as this special world, and in some ways it is, like, especially if you look at more specific game engines like Unreal Engine or something, like, learning that specifically is, of course, you know, a very specific domain. But game development in general, like, especially with modern app development, like, there are so many overlaps, you know, everywhere, especially as people are starting to use some of the game development techniques, like we just talked about. But also, like, things like using the GPU for machine learning and using Metal, Apple's graphics rendering API, to compute machine learning algorithms or machine learning problems. That just bridges that gap even further, because now you have all these data scientist people who are using tools that previously game developers were using, you know, to render their 3D games. But now, you know, they're also being applied to machine learning and to other kinds of problems. So it's super cool to see. So next up on this episode is, of course, another entry of the Rambo Report. This is going to be a little bit of a quick one, but Rambo, do you have some quick updates for us this week?
Yes, I heard from a credible source of mine. We heard about this new rumored MacBook Pro, a 16-inch one, that would come later this year. Could be even unveiled during WWDC. And I have a source that says they've played with this new MacBook Pro.
Ooh.
And I have no reason to doubt them. And they said something very intriguing. They said that this MacBook Pro has a touch bar, but it has a physical escape key.
Oh, man. That would be awesome. That would actually make me buy a touch bar MacBook Pro again.
Vim users are going to be happy.
Yeah. Well, anyone who writes text, like, I hit that escape key like 1,000 times per day. I need my escape key.
You'll get used to it, John. At least you can't break the virtual ESC key.
Right, at least it doesn't get stuck. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Oh, that's very cool. And it would also make sense because you would actually, I think, get even more symmetry that way because you've got the Touch ID sensor on the right. You know, if we still assume that they're going to keep Touch ID, which seems, you know, to be the thing. And on the left side, you would then have the escape key. So it would look pretty cool too, I think.
Yeah, and there's also some confusion going on because yesterday a new Ming-Chi Kuo report came out and he talks about a new MacBook Pro, a new iPad, and the new Apple display. And he mentions the new MacBook Pro for ends of 2020 or beginning
2021
of...
2021,
Yeah, 2021. Yeah. And some people thought he was talking about this previous MacBook Pro he talked about, the 16-inch one. But he's actually talking about what would be even a further generation of this new machine, which would include a mini LED backlight. So
those are two
separate devices in this case.
They're not the same device.
Yeah, exactly. So some confusion going on there. And since we mentioned the Kuo report, we should also talk about the new display. So this Apple display would have 31.6 inches, and it would include the micro LED. Let me correct myself. The new MacBook Pro and the new iPad he mentioned for 2020, 2021, those would have micro mini LED displays. So the pixels would be mini LED. What will have a mini LED backlight is the 31.6 inch external display. And that's right. Coming this year, according to him.
Yeah, that's super cool. And the difference here is, again, like the backlight and the actual display technology, right? Just like how you can have a LED display with LCD backlight, right?
Yeah, so I guess this using mini LED for a backlight gives more control over the backlights in different areas of the screen. So they can probably have a very good contrast without having to be OLED.
Yeah, and that would be super cool in a pro display because, you know, one thing that I've gotten really, really used to and, you know, it's hard to get unused to it is when you have the LED display on the new iPhones, like I've got the iPhone X, when you read text that is just on black and for example, I implemented a black theme specifically for the iPhone X devices where, you know, the background is completely black, like the pixels are off and the text is white and it just like makes for a really nice, comfortable read. And when I'm sitting in front of my computer and I'm also using like the same kind of theme in my text editor, I'm just wishing for that to be like the same experience of the screen being completely black.
That's why we usually see off black backgrounds in dark modes in LCD displays because the pure black doesn't look good.
Yeah.
In a non OLED display or like a common LED display. So it looks like, I don't know, it looks washed out.
if almost that's like even a gradient, right? Yeah, it looks like a gradient coming from the sides because the light works that way, that the light is like stronger around the edges. I mean, that's at least my perception. And it just makes for a kind of uneven color in general.
Yeah, so looking forward to this new MacBook Pro and this new display later this year.
Yeah, super exciting stuff. All right, so should we round off this episode by doing some hashtag AskStackTrace?
Absolutely.
So first of all, we have a pretty big announcement here. It's not the 1st of April anymore, but our good friend Michał Nierbierski, he made an announcement on our behalf on the 1st of April, which was that the StackTrace motion picture is coming out.
Oh, that one we talked about, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be a big thing. We're going to put a link in the show notes to this tweet. It's really funny by Michał. He made like a nice fake display of a movie with StackTrace. So that was a good April Fool's joke. So thanks for that, Michał.
Yeah, you can also look in your podcast player. It will be the chapter image.
Perfect. That's great. The wonders of podcasting technology. They never cease to amaze me. All right, and for our question that we want to answer on this episode comes from Lonnie. And Lonnie wants to know, what are some of our beginner mistakes that we made when we started writing iOS apps? So back when you were a young Rambo, what mistakes were you making when you first started writing iOS apps that you now look back on and thinking, oh, what was I doing back then?
Well, I think the if I would mention everything, we could stay here for a long time. So I'm going to pick some things that come to mind. The first one is that basically every year I would rewrite my app.
All right.
So I had this app. It was in the App Store. It was used to track packages with the Brazilian Postal Service. And yeah, basically every year I would want to make a new version of the app, and I would just rewrite the app from scratch.
Yeah, that's a sign that the architecture didn't really, you know, age well.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also not necessarily that the architecture didn't age well, but also that it's a sign of an inexperienced developer, because when you're inexperienced and you see a code base that has issues, the first thing you want to do is just rewrite everything. And yeah, that's almost always a bad idea. So yeah, that's something I learned.
Yeah, absolutely. Me too. I definitely agree with that point. And I think that when you are in the beginning of your career, you also don't really understand the cost of a full rewrite. Like, it's easy for us to trick ourselves when we look at a problem, and it relates to what we talked about earlier with air power. Like, you look at something like that and you think, that's easy. You might not look at air power and think that that's easy, but you look at building like a table view, like a UI that shows tracking codes or packages, and you think to yourself, well, that's going to take me like 2 hours to re-implement, so why don't I just rewrite it? But as you get older and wiser, hopefully, and you know, you get more experience, you start to realize that that's definitely not true. Because, for example, what makes you believe that the app that you spent maybe 2 months working on, you could now write in like a week? You know, just because you know how to do it, or, you know, you have an idea on how you're going to do it, doesn't mean that it's going to be so much faster. And that's definitely like a big learning for me, is also like not to constantly just rewrite and rewrite things and throw away code that is working, even though I might look at it and think, this is not good code, but it's working. Like, if it's working, let it be there, refactor it instead, improve it over time, and, you know, work on systems around it to make it better, but don't throw away the code that is already working. So that's definitely a big beginner mistake for me as well.
Yeah, when you rewrite code that's already working, no matter how ugly it might be, you usually end up losing features if it's an app, because you remove the feature in the hope that you're gonna re-implement it, and sometimes you end up not re-implementing it, and your users will miss that. See Final Cut Pro 10.
Right, exactly.
And also, you end up regressing on many bugs that the old code was fixing. And sometimes part of why the code can be ugly is because there are these edge cases it's accounting for, which you don't even remember. And then you rewrite it, and you're not accounting for these edge cases anymore. And then this bug, which was fixed before, starts happening in production again. And it was your mistake for removing the bug fixing code. So, and that's, of course, a mistake as well, because you probably should have documented better when you made that maybe ugly looking code to fix some edge case. You should have at least added a comment as to why that was there, which are, by the way, the best code comments. I think the only reasonable code comments inside an implementation is explaining why something is there, not what is being done.
Yeah, that's a good point. And of course, even better is to add tests, but we're talking about beginners here, and that's not the first thing beginners think about is, well, let's add a test suite for this. But that's, of course, another thing I've learned throughout my career, is to really use tests in a good way, and not to become like super obsessed with testing and just like do all everything test-driven development, but rather just use them as a tool in order to verify my code and to verify the quality of it, and also use it as a refactoring tool. Like, before I start refactoring something, make sure that it has a solid suite of tests so that I don't regress, like you mentioned, so that I don't miss a feature that was, you know, supposed to work.
Yeah, I will only use testing as a refactoring tool, just to put it out there that most of my code that's in production right now doesn't have any tests.
Yeah.
I have no shame in saying that.
That's fine, but yeah.
When I think about refactoring something, I start with tests. So if you see code of mine out there that has tests, it's probably because I had to refactor it and I was scared.
Nice. Yeah, I think it's definitely like you can always pick and choose what tools you want to use for your development, you know, and there's nothing saying that test is the only way to go. I personally really like tests, especially for like packages and libraries and logic and things like that, because it lets me work really fast with things like open source projects because I can just rely on the tests. But yeah, there are definitely lots of different ways to work. You know, I'd definitely not saying that, you know, using tests is the way to go. There are definitely multiple approaches. But the number one thing I think that I've learned since being a beginner, like my biggest rookie mistakes were all around just code structure in general. Like I used to always take the path of least resistance, which usually meant implementing everything in one place. Like I would build, you know, one app that had all the code in the app delegates, and then I would move on from that to having all the code in one view controller, and then I would build massive view controllers, like I think a lot of iOS developers have done. And then after a while, you know, I started learning about separation of concerns. You know, again, testing came into the picture. I realized in order to make more testable code, I needed to separate things out. But really, like what I can see just looking back at my career as a software developer, it's really been just this gradual change towards building smaller and simpler things. And, you know, we talked about in the beginning of this episode now with my static site generator, I'm building that as a very, very separated suite of tools. And that's just the complete opposite to how I would do things when I got started. Like if someone told me, you know, when I was a beginner, build a static site generator. First of all, static site generators weren't popular back then, and I could probably never have built one because I didn't have the skills. But let's just say that I did. I would probably just have implemented as one file, you know, just like static site generator.swift. And now my approach is completely different, where I've realized the big value in having a proper architecture, planning things a little bit more upfront, not just jumping in and coding from day one. And just, you know, separating things out, giving things proper purposes instead of just mashing it all into one file.
Yeah, I want to give also two tips that I learned. And this one comes up a lot when I'm reviewing junior developer's code, which is the single source of truth kind of situation. And what I mean by that is, you want to have a single source of truth in context. So let's say you need to keep track of whether the user has enabled notifications. You should have one place that's responsible for telling you if the user has enabled notifications. If you start, because I see sometimes in junior code, like let's say there's a preference in user defaults for that. There's like a preferences class that has all the handling for that. And then this person goes and just adds a property to a view controller, are notifications enabled, and returns the value for the user defaults key directly.
Right.
That's exactly. A simple example, but there are more complicated ones. And then you start spreading the data of your app around and then, yeah, things start breaking in very unpredictable ways.
Yeah, it kind of ties into the thing I mentioned, like around structure, because it's the same fundamental problem is that when you're a junior developer, like you're just concerned about getting things done. You know, you don't have all the knowledge about architectures and, you know, single source of truth and separation of concerns. You might have read it in a book or on a in a blog post, but You haven't really worked with it because you're a beginner, right? It makes sense. So you're just focused on like getting this button on the screen, getting this thing to render, getting notifications to be displayed. And you will just take the path of least resistance usually to get there. So I think it's fine. You know, in the beginning, you have to learn somehow, and learning by doing is a good thing. But it's always good to pair up with someone like you when you're reviewing some junior developer's code, who can help you out and guide you along the way. But I think it's also important to point out that making mistakes is an important way of learning. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
You can't write perfect code from the beginning. You need to have these dirty projects that you're working on, hopefully, you know, as side projects and not just like polluting your company's code base. But you need to have these projects where you're just coding, because that's how you learn, like without thinking too much about structure from day one, because that's just going to make things super slow for you in the beginning.
Yeah, and you also have to keep in mind when it's like when you're prototyping something. I have my experiments folder in my projects folder is basically a bunch of hacks that have no structure at all, and most of them have everything implemented in a single file, but those are not shipping apps.
right,
and
exactly.
You mentioned, we mentioned good practices, basically. So separation of concerns and single source of truth. And there are many architectures out there which promise to solve these issues. But from my experience, there is no architecture out there that can solve these issues for you. Those are things you need to care about when you're working on your project, and then it doesn't matter what architecture you're using. You can be working with MVC, MVVM, Viper, whatever. You are going to take care of that. You don't need an architecture to take care of things for you. You need to be worried about that stuff. Just something I want to put out there, because I am tired of the whole architecture thing.
So then maybe you shouldn't listen to the last episode of Swift by Sundell, which is all about app architectures. Well, you should still listen to it, Rambo. I think you're going to like it.
If it's a pragmatic conversation, I'm definitely going to listen. I'm just tired of people just preaching their particular architecture. And that's why I made iosarchitecture.top.
Oh yeah, that's an awesome one. If you haven't checked that out, it's super funny. It's a website that Rambo made to generate architecture names, which is just hilarious. So we're going to put a link to that in the show notes as well.
Yeah. So, last tip, because I mentioned I was going to give two and only gave one. if you have an app, especially if it's in the App Store and it doesn't have a debug screen, you're doing something wrong. You need to have a debug screen in your app.
Like a way to for yourself, like for your own custom tooling as you're working on it.
Yeah, you need to have like a table view with some switches you can turn on and off to fiddle with things. And yeah, that's I think it's very important. And if you have automated, even if you have automated testing, you should be testing your apps manually. And having a debug menu in your app helps a lot with that. Just remember to if dev debug it.
Yeah, I was about to say that. or hashtag if debug if you're using Swift. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, those are some really good tips. So make sure to keep sending us questions. We do love to get questions from you. So you can tweet to anyone or just out into the Twitter sphere with the hashtag AskStackTrace. And we're going to pick that up and hopefully answer your question on a future episode. But that's it for this episode. So thank you so much for listening, everybody. You can find us, like always, on Twitter. I am at John Sundell. Mr. Rambo is at _inside. Feel free to tell us what you think about the show. You know, we love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, just send it our way. We also love to hear that. So until then, that's it for this episode. Say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.